is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 17, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And please check out my other podcast, it's called The Past Lives Podcast, and there are over 200 episodes. On The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. And this is the free version of the episode. The extended episode is 23 minutes longer. And to get access to the extra 23 minutes, you can join the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $7.50 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And there are now 17 extended episodes available, but the back catalogue will grow every week. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and the links are in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. This week I'm talking to Dr. Robert Farrell about his book, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. He has lectured many times at universities, science centres, MUFON meetings, bookstores, clubs, and senior centres around the country, and he has appeared on numerous TV and radio shows, including Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. Hi there, Bob. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Your book is called The Science Behind Alien Encounters. And so when it's talking about science, what is your background?
I worked as an engineer for about 20 years in industry, basically. And my last 5 years, I was a vice president of engineering. And the company manufactured plastics equipment, you know, injection molding machines and things like that. So one day I got a letter from a recruiter that Penn State had hired because they wanted to start a plastics program in Erie, Pennsylvania. There was a lot of plastics industry around there, and they wanted a homegrown program. So the letter asked if there was anybody who had worked for me that might be interested, and it took me a whole month to figure out it was me. And so I applied and got the job. There was another gentleman who also came out of industry, and we both had a marketing background. You know, my doctorate's in plastics, but I have an MBA, and so did he, so we both had a marketing background. So the first day we got together to talk about what we're going to do for the program. First question we asked was, well, who's our customer? And you'd be surprised how many people in academia cannot answer that question. They haven't figured it out, but we did. We said, the student is our customer. And that's a key point, because then the next thing you do is you ask, well, what do they want? What does the customer want? And if you give the customer what they want, whatever you're doing, that business will thrive. And that has been our experience. We started with 4 students, and about a year or so before I announced retirement, we were up to 270 students in our program. And our students got the highest starting salaries on our campus, other than MBA students, and 100% employment. So we spent our energy actually going into industry and making them aware of what we offered, you know, what our product was, basically. And we had our students involved in doing undergraduate research papers and presenting at conferences. And toward the end of my years there, about 75% of all the undergraduate student papers that we presented, it was an annual international technical conference. And we had 75% of the papers came from our campus. So that got people's attention. So well, anyway, that's how I got into academia. And so I taught at Penn State University for 15 years. Toward the end, I started attending UFO conferences. And that's how I really started doing more of the deep research. So I've been doing that for probably 30 years. But the problem was that I saw was at every conference, the big issue was, well, when is there going to be disclosure? And my feeling was, you're not going to get disclosure until the voters ask for it. And so that's why when I retired and I had this knowledge that I wanted to share about UFOs, I started writing. But I decided that in order to get the voters interested in the topic, because you know, starting with like 1953, the government did everything they could to make people look like they're crazy if they reported UFOs. So and they were successful at doing that. But so I thought, well, the only way I'm going to convince the voters that this is a reality is to give out the information in the form of science fiction. So when they read the science fiction, they accidentally receive a lot of information because what comes out of the dialogue is well researched. So that's how I got into the science fiction part of it. And that was what I first started writing. And also when I retired, I started lecturing. And the title of my lecture was The Science Behind Alien Encounters, which is what the book is. And I started lecturing in 2004. And after a couple of years, it was so well received because people seemed to be hungry for the information. So I decided to cast it into a book. And the book you have read is the second edition. So it's an expanded version over what I started with. But I don't know, that kind of gives you a summary, I guess, where I am.
And you say in the book that you stay away from parallel universes, dimensions, wormholes, time travel. Why is it you're avoiding that stuff?
Yes, because my feeling was, you know, this UFO stuff is like magic to a lot of people. They don't, first of all, have been trained not to believe it. And they can say, well, there's no way anything can do these amazing things. And so I felt I had to take a nuts and bolts approach and do it scientifically, basically based on science that the average person would have when they graduated from high school. And I avoided other, you know, like fifth dimensions and wormholes and all those things, because that just is one more level that you got to overcome. And so if I could explain things in a very simple nuts and bolts fashion and show evidence, I thought, okay, there's a chance that they're going to believe, but yeah, they could be for real. And that way, my whole goal, don't ask me why I'm doing this, because when I retired from Penn State, I had a different idea what retirement would be, but turns out I'm motivated now to try and, you might say, educate the public about this so that when the disclosure comes, it won't be a sudden shock. They'll be ready for it. And that's what I'm trying to do with my lectures and my books.
And you talk about how it was simple logic that led you to the conviction that extraterrestrial life exists. So what was the bits and pieces that came to you that you could use your logic to decide that?
Well, first of all, anybody looks up into the sky at night has to believe that there's got to be other life out there. So that was kind of a given that there's intelligent life out there. And then in regards to the UFOs and what they could do, there was only one hypothesis in my mind that could satisfy the data. And when I say the data, when I was in industry, I would get involved in failure analysis sometimes. And so I found, well, you lay out all the information that you can gather on a failure, and the answer stares at you. So I thought, okay, I don't have access to any broken UFOs to you know, scientifically say, well, this. What I have access to is reports by credible witnesses, you know, like astronauts and people who run radar equipment, things like that, pilots. So there's a lot of credible witness reports out there if you read them, and they describe what they saw. And so you like list all the things that they have seen these things do. And in my mind, the only possible scenario is that they are propelling their craft with gravitational field propulsion, because I can explain how a lot of the things that people report is explained by gravitational field propulsion. Excuse me. In my lecture and in the book that you have read, I can also explain how they cloak themselves. There's a couple of ways they could do that, because people have seen them they see them and then they don't see it. It's like they just suddenly disappear. And a lot of evidence that they have the ability to cloak themselves. And there's a lot of evidence in my mind that shows that they're not only using a gravitational field, but it's a negative field. And that's a hard sell because we don't have an experience normally in a negative field. But I talk about experiments that have been done either through serendipity, they just produced a field and they weren't sure if it was negative or positive. But when you analyze the data, it was probably a negative field. We talk about photographs of UFOs taking off and there's a cloud of dust that is kicked up when they take off. And you can see underneath the craft how the dust is clear areas where there's no dust. And I interpret that as meaning that it's being expelled by the negative field that is actually lifting the craft up. And then there's a story once about a car in Illinois where actually a UFO ran into it, and it was cloaked, and it was being protected by a negative field that puts around itself as a shield, you might say. And so the next morning, because the driver didn't see anything other than suddenly the car lurched to the right. And next day you look at the car and the left side is all caved in. There's no scratches or blood or anything like that, like maybe an animal hit them. But had a UFO hit them with this negative field, it would have, pushed in the side of the car. And so the question is, what happened? Why did the driver do that? In my lecture, I joked, well, maybe the driver of the UFO was texting, but who knows?
In the book, there's a thing you talk about. There's a man who exited his car and observed a flying saucer about 30 feet overhead. And when it accelerated upwards, something happened.
Pushed him down. That's right. So, like I say, this is all data. You lay it out there, and there's data. I'm trying to think of other good. Well, freezing of ponds, and I can explain that because there've been instances where people come upon a shallow pond, and there's evidence that a UFO had just left there, had been hovering over that pond, and even though it might be cold out, it wasn't freezing weather, but yet the pond was frozen. And so how can that be? Well, again, that's evidence for a negative gravity underneath the craft, because it would be expelling the air, creating a low pressure, if you will, over the surface of the pond. And of course, under a low pressure, the water evaporates faster. And in evaporation, the molecules are taking energy away as they leave. And so what's left behind gets colder and colder and colder, and finally it freezes. And that's basically the refrigeration process. Cooling towers use that same process to cool. So, but that to me is another evidence that it's a negative field.
And this kind of reminds me of Bob Lazar and the work he talked about doing at, was it Area 51, where it was some kind of gravity generator that would produce a gravity wave that was inverse to the Earth's gravity wave. Have you read all that stuff?
Yes. In fact, first of all, I have to say when Lazar first came forward, basically years ago, I was a skeptic, especially when he said, well, they use element 115. Well, of course, that hadn't even been discovered yet, so that was a strike against him. But eventually, we actually discovered the element 115. And the thing that was interesting to me is in an interview that I saw him do, he mentioned that he tried, his partner was working on this project with him. They had this generator, they called it, the size of a basketball, that was generating this gravitational field. And his partner said, try and touch it. So he went to touch it, and as he got closer, it was like a magnet, two opposing north fields. They oppose each other, and that's the way his hand felt. He says, as it got closer, it was harder and harder. He said, so it was a repulsive field that was coming out of that generator. Again, more evidence for a negative field.
It makes me wonder about Travis Walton's experience, because I'm sure you know that he was close to a craft and something hit him and knocked him to the ground, and his crew thought he'd been killed. And I'm wondering if some kind of field that you're talking about accidentally hit him.
Oh, sure. He claims you're talking about fire in the sky, basically.
Yeah.
Travis Walton. Yeah. Yeah, I've actually met him several times. He's just, you know, a straight shooter, basically. And he's on the same mission I am. He goes around lecturing about his experience, trying to convince people that this is a reality. But yeah, he felt, now he feels that they would actually try to, they brought him aboard the craft because they thought they had damaged him when he was accidentally hit by this beam. And he also had said, at least in his lectures, that he regrets the movie that came out at first because it didn't accurately portray his situation. But he had signed the rights away, you know, to the movie company, and so he had no way to control it. But subsequently, he's now been going around and trying to set the record straight. And he doesn't feel that they meant him harm, but they were just like, I think, and this is true of most abductions, where someone is picked up in the field someplace or driving their car, who knows, taken aboard a craft and examined and then let go. It's kind of the same thing we might do if we're exploring strange country or a jungle, and we would, you know, pick up an animal to study it, tag it maybe. So my belief is they're not malevolent. I think they might be watching over us because we're getting pretty close to the point of destroying the planet. And I'm hoping they step in pretty soon. But that was Travis's experience.
Yeah, I was talking to, you know, Mike Cleland recently, and he said there seems to be a message that ETs transfer during abductions where they're saying your technology has far outstripped your spirituality and this is dangerous.
That's exactly right. And that's why I feel too, that these beings, not only are they far ahead of us technologically, but also spiritually. Another reason why I don't fear them, I don't think they mean us harm. And I think, in fact, if you somehow I managed to get into books written by Zachariah Sitchin, the late Zachariah, if you haven't read them, I would encourage at least reading The 12th Planet, because he led me into a deeper area of this whole field of ufology and wanting to know more about the ancient cases. And of course, Sitchin was curious to know about the origin of his religion. He was Jewish, and he did a lot of research, written in a number of languages, but The 12th Planet was the first book he wrote of his Earth Chronicles. And so his interpretation of what he gathered from actually reading cuneiform and studying mythology was that the Sumerians believed that there was another planet that orbited the Earth, and they called it Nibiru, and the Anunnaki came from the planet Nibiru. Now, at the time Sitchin wrote that, his book came out in 1976, if you went up and talked to an astronomer and said, what do you think about these rogue planets? And he would say, what? Because they didn't really know anything about rogue planets. And so, but Sitchin put it out there that the Sumerians knew about this rogue planet. Today, now, using gravitational lensing techniques, because you can't see a rogue planet, it's dark in the sense that it's not radiating a lot of energy, so they'd be hard to find. But by using techniques of gravitational lensing, they can now detect these bodies. And in fact, some think that there may be, for every planet in this, in our galaxy, for every four planets, I should say, Jupiter-sized planets, there may be a rogue planet wandering around. And it was either thrown off from a solar system, or it could have formed on its own, just like the sun did, but its mass was too small to start any fusion. So just a dead planet, but it might have moons. And in fact, Nibiru supposedly had 11 moons. And the interesting thing is, according to the mythology, this Nibiru in one of its orbits, and its orbit took 3,600 years to complete. And the closest approach, as near as I can tell, is where the asteroid belt is. And so according to the Sumerian mythology, this Nibiru encountered a planet called Tiamat. It was in orbit where the asteroid belt is, and one of its moons crashed into it and damaged it, and another moon eventually split it up into what we call the asteroid belt, and the other half was a large chunk that had a large moon that ended up down where Earth is today. Well, that actually explains some things that astronomers are wrestling with right now, because where our Earth is, it should not be, it should not have as much water as it has, because it's so close to the sun. And so how do you explain that? And they've tried different theories and none of them work. But they did do some research on the ratio of hydrogen and deuterium. It's a certain ratio that occurs on the water on the planet Earth. And when we brought stuff back from the moon, guess what? It matched what's on the Earth. When they sampled water from asteroid, the asteroid that came from deep space beyond Neptune, the ratio was three times higher than on Earth. If they sampled the water that was in a meteorite that they knew had come from the asteroid belt, guess what? It matched the Earth. So that data points to the fact that maybe the Earth actually did originate out there. The other thing is, the further you go out away from the sun, you find more water. Ceres, which is the largest asteroid, has 25% water ice. And if you go out even further, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are, I don't know, 50% water ice. I don't remember what it is, but the point is, the further out you go, the more water you get. So there's all that evidence that says that what Sitchin had gleaned out of his studies of the Sumerian culture is probably correct. And he also said that the Sumerians believed that these Anunnaki created the first human. And he even went to the extent of saying they did that in South Africa about 200,000 or 300,000 years ago. And they were in the process of mining gold when they first came here. And so I think they created these humans to be slaves to help mine gold or do whatever they needed to get done. And again, he put that in his book that he wrote in 1976. And it was 10 years later, in 1986, that some researchers out of University of California had been studying the mitochondrial DNA from placenta, that they had, I think, 147 different placentas from around the world. And they came to a conclusion independently that the first human appeared in South Africa about 200,000 or 300,000 years ago. And guess what? It was right in an area where there are known thousands of ancient gold mines, well, hundreds anyway, hundreds of ancient gold mines. So everything Sitchin says fits together. And another thing he talked about was the Noah's flood, which was a Sumerian event. And that got me looking into that aspect, which is why I ended up writing The Science Behind Noah's Flood. And in that book, I dedicated a whole chapter of actually applying science that has occurred since 1976, applying it to show that everything Sitchin had said is true. And so that's, you know, the, when you get into this ufology thing, you kind of end up going in all kinds of directions, because you've got to find out about our ancient history and how aliens may have impacted that. And it's a fascinating field, I have to say.
So if that planet Nibiru is currently out there and it's in a really long orbit, was it 3,600 years, when could we expect it to come back and the scientists can spot it?
That is a good question. I did a quick calculation, and in its farthest approach, it's I think I figured it was like 10 times further out than Pluto, and it spends almost all of its time beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And in fact, I calculated that probably only maybe 5 years or 10 years of that 3,600 years would it be visible inside the orbit of Jupiter. But it would probably be fairly bright, be like a bright star at night when it came And again, here, Sitchin had determined that it would appear coming from the southern hemisphere. And so I tie that in with a later discovery that I'm not even sure if Zachariah Sitchin had a chance to actually go there, but Göbekli Tepe, which is it's supposedly the oldest monolithic structure on the planet Earth. And the archaeologist who's passed away, Dr. Schmidt, had spent like 20 years digging, and he'd uncovered four of the rings, which were really, and he was convinced that they were probably religious sites. But he dated them on the surface to be about 12,000 years ago. And he dated, he said, with ground penetrating radar, there were more further down for a total of 20. And he said some of those might be 14,000 years old. So in the science behind Noah's Flood, I dated the Noah's Flood to be about 14,500 years ago. And the result, and again, I even got into this subject because Sitchin said that he believed that Noah's Flood was caused by a mega tsunami created by the collapsing ice sheets in Antarctica. But he thought that it was the periodic arrival of Nibiru that created a gravitational field, you know, that was large enough to cause instability and cause these huge ice sheets to crash into the Indian Ocean and create this tsunami. So that led me into researching all that stuff. And so I think he was off maybe by 1,000 or 2,000 years. But I think he's right in that, because if you look at the sea level, there are maps of sea level going back 20,000 years. And 20 to 15,000 years ago, sea level was 370 feet lower than it is today. And if you look at the soundings of Persian Gulf, the deepest part is only like 150 feet deep, which means that it was a lake. Back 15,000 years ago, it was a lake. And guess what? Fed by four rivers, just like the Bible said. And it was streaming down probably through a gully or a ravine into the Indian Ocean. And then the mega tsunami, which would have been created by this 8 mile high ice sheets, I mean, huge ice sheets along the eastern edge of Antarctica, which faces the directly toward the Straits of Hormuz. And so when that starts, you know, calving, the energy that it releases would be horrendous. And at that period in time, about 14,500 years ago, there was the Bolling-Alerod warming spell where the planet was warming up. And so that would have caused, again, first of all, the ice sheets loaded on the water to break up. And those once those ice sheets leave, of course, when they melt, break up, they would change the sea level. But when they break away from the coast, they no longer prevent the huge glaciers from marching forward and carried into the sea. And so I think it wasn't Nibiru that caused this disaster, you might say, but rather just the fact that a warming trend as we came out of the ice age. And the interesting thing, if you take that date and say, okay, Noah, you know, got involved in this flood, and it was a big flood, about 14,000 years ago, and he would have been carried northwest between the Tigris and Euphrates River. And in fact, the mythology says that Noah, actually it was called Upnapishtim in the mythology, that he resided at the headwaters of the Euphrates River. Guess where that is? That's in Turkey, just over the border from, might be Syria. But anyway, it's in southeastern Turkey. And that's where Göbekli Tepe is. And there's a town or a site called Novella Cori, which is at the headwaters of the Euphrates. There's now a dam there, create a lake, but before they finished the dam, archaeologists went in to explore the ruins that were at Corina Valley. And the structure, architecture of the structure strongly resembled what appeared in Göbekli Tepe. And the interesting thing is, in both cases, both at the Valakori and also in all of the rings at Göbekli Tepe, there's rings of stones. There's like a dozen stones erected that represent, I think, the deities, because the Sumerians had 12 deities, and that's what reason there's 12 zodiac symbols in the sky. But the two main gods are tall columns in the center with anthropomorphic images on the front, like hands coming around and on their waist. And they always are facing toward the south, each one at a different angle, because if they're looking for Nibiru, which I think they were, I mean, that would have been a major event when Nibiru appears. And so these two gods are facing in that direction, overlooking the Valley of Haran. So it all ties together, you know, and it has to.
So with the modern era of UFOs, you say in the book you believe that the first atomic bomb tests were what got ETs interested in us.
Yeah, I think so. As a matter of fact, if you go back to 1947, for instance, Arnold, who was the first pilot to kind of report seeing, he didn't call them flying saucers, but the press called them flying saucers. That was in June of 1947. And that same month, Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer, two famous people who happened to be employed, you might say, at Princeton University, they had this meeting, I guess it was a secret meeting, to discuss these celestial visitors, they called them. And it was interesting that it seemed like the biggest concern was what property rights they might have, because maybe they already been on the moon, so they own the moon, you know, that kind of thing. But they referred to them as celestial visitors, and they said, well, maybe our nuclear testing, or, you know, firing off nuclear bombs got their attention. That was what they thought. And that they actually did that before Roswell, because Roswell was in July. So it was a busy year in 1947.
There's this idea you have that perhaps it's technology that we were using that caused the UFOs to crash. And you talk about the Kingman crash in 1953 that may have been caused by a nuclear test.
Yes. Now, there is another scenario that says that wasn't caused by a nuclear test, but they thought that was actually caused by radar, that high-powered radar had disabled their craft. And if indeed they are creating their gravitational field by manipulating the electromagnetic field, which is what I believe, and Einstein would have said that, then, yeah, they'd be susceptible to a high-powered beams like from radar. But I did some research, and in 1953, in that area, they weren't quite yet to that point in radar development. They eventually did build a radar site there, but it was after the fact. And I happen to remember that particular event in May of 1953. I was in high school, and I knew I was almost late for school because it was going to be televised. They're going to televise this atomic blast, and you know, I wanted to stay home and watch it. So I almost was late for school. But they wanted the public to see that the atomic attack would be survivable. I think that was the whole image of why they televised it. But I could imagine, because of the interest they had, that UFOs had in what we were doing, that they would have had scout ships stationed in that area to monitor these tests. And it so happens that the previous test, which was in the same area, and it was, I think, also a tower test, occurred a little bit earlier in time, like maybe an hour before the Dirty Harry test, which is what they called it. And so I'm imagining you're aboard this UFO, and you know that they do this testing, and hey, it's past time. What's going on? So maybe they moved in closer to analyze it because they could use the infrared beams and stuff and actually probably see what's going wrong. And they got too close. and the bomb went off. And I don't care what kind of UFO you have, it probably wouldn't be survived, couldn't survive in the middle of an atomic blast. And so I think it was wounded or damaged. And so they were able, though, to control the craft long enough to get a couple hundred miles away before they landed in Arizona. Yeah, they made it to Arizona. And that's where, 1953, the craft was found. The cause of the crash was the fact it was damaged while it was observing Dirty Harry.
And there may be other crashes that happened over time. You know, obviously Roswell's famous, but one of the questions that you ask in the book is, how can UFOs crash if their technology is so good? Because they're presumably are much more advanced than us.
Yeah, well, of course, if they're too close to an atomic bomb when it goes off, that'd probably be one reason. But also, because I would discuss this with the late Stanton Friedman, who's kind of an icon, he was. But he, of course, was a nuclear engineer in his training. And it was his theory that these were crashing because of the radar, high-powered radar that was being developed during World War II. And it so happens that, most of the places where they were crashing was where they had high-powered radar. And again, that probably would have disrupted their propulsion system and they could have crashed.
So you also go into the religious implications of this stuff, and you talk about Monsignor Corrado Balducci. Could you tell us about him, what he said?
Yeah, his background, I think he had been an exorcist out of the Vatican. But he had, for several years, two or three, maybe 4 years, been very outspoken about ETs and UFOs. And I guess had been on Rome Radio a number of times. So he was a logical choice to have as the keynote speaker at the 2005 X conference that was held just outside of Washington, D.C. And I'll finish that story in a minute, but I just want to say of all the religions, I think the Catholic religion is the most proactive in trying to address this problem, because I think that was the mission that he had been assigned, maybe, is to get out there and kind of test the waters, you know, start talking about this stuff and get people prepared for the fact that, yes, there might be other beings out there. And in fact, that's what he said at the X conference in his keynote speech. He said that there's so much evidence now that we can't deny that there might be other intelligent beings like humans. And so that was kind of his bottom line, that how can we deny that? And how can we put limits on God's creativity? And then later on, 2008, I think it was, the head of the Vatican Observatory made a similar statement that how can we, and that's the bottom line. That's what I tell people, you know, if I encounter someone who believes deeply in the Bible and says, well, there can't be anything beyond Earth. And then I say, well, how can you put a limit on God's creation? Because that's what they'd be doing.
Yeah, it's a good question. If God is omnipotent being who created this universe that is so big, why would there just be life on this one tiny planet and this one galaxy?
That's right. And in fact, I write science fiction, but I try and make the dialogue basically me speaking based on the research that I had done. And in the second book of Alien Log, I have Alien Log as the first, Alien Log number two, The New World Order. And I think it was in that book that there was a discussion between a human and the alien. And the alien was explaining how they had, the scientists had discovered 500,000 years ago that there was a creator of the universe. And I had read a doctoral thesis that a student of theology had written, and he went through a mathematical solution that prove that it was impossible for our universe to come about accidentally. It had to have intelligence behind it. And so the aliens believe that, at least in my book, you know, that they believe in a higher being, I guess you could say. But you know, I don't know if you want to call that religion or not, but they believed in a creator.
Yeah, I was talking to a guest on the podcast recently who said that there were some ETs that some abductees talked about, and these ETs believed in some kind of higher power or higher source.
Yeah. And even in cases where people have had near-death experiences, they talk about approaching a light and being overwhelmed by the amount of love that they felt, to the extent that they almost didn't want to come back. And that's the way I feel about it. You know, I'm not wanting to die now because life's too interesting. There's a lot more I want to see and do. But I'm not afraid of dying, and I believe no matter what, excuse me, no matter what, I'll be welcomed into heaven, because I believe that God is a God of unconditional love. There's no conditions required to get into heaven. Even people say, "Well, do you mean even Hitler got in?" I don't know, but if it's unconditional, it's unconditional. That's what I believe.
So, if we change the subject now, quite a lot, I think.
Yes, we have.
What's your view on crop circles? Because you do write a little bit about them in the book, and there's a lot of people who just feel they're just a hoax.
Yes, well, you know, Dave and Doug Corley, you know, in what, 1991 was it, that they went on public television and said, well, we're the ones that are making these crop circles. And they took the camera crew out into the field, and armed with some boards and string, they made a crop circle. And so right away, people thought, well, okay, they're all hoax. But if they're the ones that made them, they were really busy, because there were like thousands of them made. But I believe that these are signs that maybe our intelligence is being tested. Because right now, if they would land on planet Earth, I mean, overtly, not covertly, to have a discussion with us, what could we bring to the table to talk about? I think we're pretty dumb relative to them. So maybe they're measuring our intelligence with these crop circles, because a lot of them have information embedded in them and new stuff, you know, I guess. But the way they are created, they cannot really be created, at least not as fast, by people. They have certain things about them that make them unique. For one thing, Dr. Levengood, I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he got involved. He was a plant biologist and well known, and so somehow he got involved in this crop circle thing, and they sent samples to him, both samples out of the crop circle and samples nearby, you know, the control samples. And one of the things he observed with the nodes and the plants had evidence of being heated very rapidly, like if they were inside a radar oven. And there were expulsion cavities where the steam would have blown out. And the cavities were, those nodes were elongated. Also, the stems weren't broken. They were bent over in a true, and I have not been in a crop circle, but I've always wanted to go. Maybe I'll come and visit you sometime and we can. But also, supposedly, in the soil, there's a high concentration of nickel in there. And people who have gone into these say that it's an unusual experience. Either they get nauseous, maybe, or it's almost like a religious experience for them. So it has an effect on their minds. They claim that birds won't fly over them. I don't know if that's true, but... they are very unusual. I don't think they're man-made, and I think the designs are created in a way to give us information or test our intelligence. And in Alien Log, the first book, one of the main characters, Corey is his name, is an astrophysicist, and he's asked about this. And it was his feeling that that UFOs were creating them, and they were doing this with radiation, you know, like microwave. And but in the second book, he's having a chat with an alien, and he's made to think about, well, maybe there's another way to do the same thing. How about ultrasound? And so now maybe Corey's now thinking, aha, ultrasound perhaps could have been used. There was a scientist, he was actually a doctor, I think, a medical doctor, but also a scientist in his mind, who was studying ultrasound. And he could create designs by vibrating iron filings or just any kind of powder and create all kinds of designs based on the frequency and amplitude of these vibrations. So I could visualize that the craft beaming down ultrasound that could make the crops dance, if you would, and behave, and also would provide perhaps enough energy to cause the expulsion cavities. But I don't really know, other than that, how they do it. And I don't think anybody does for sure. But I haven't really been there yet to see one, so I don't know.
If we could move on, I wanted to talk to you about the last chapter, because I found this so fascinating, the Nazca mummies. Can you tell us about them?
Yes. Well, again, in the research I had done for the science behind Noah's Flood, I learned a lot about the ancient Sumerian culture. And one of the things that intrigued me with that, first of all, the Sumerians, they invented the wheel. They invented metallurgy. They, and number 12 was very important to them. They had 12 signs of the zodiac. We have two sets of 12 hours a day. Circles and other geometry is divided up into intervals of 12 degrees, like a circle, for instance, has, if you take a circle, it's not 360 degrees, it's 300, it's a number of 12 degree increments. So there's a lot of cases where 12 in their base number system, where ours is 10, you know, if you hold up your hands and you look, you see 10 fingers. Well, our base number system is 10. And in Mexico, the Aborigines there had a base 20. And I laugh. I said, well, they didn't have shoes on so they could see their toes. But the Sumerians, their base was 60, which is 5 times 12. So why 12? Well, in 2017, I attended a lecture that Jaime Masson, a lot of your listeners probably are familiar with him, very, very well known out of Mexico. And he gave the first lecture ever given in the United States about discovery of these bodies. People referred to them initially as mummies, but they're not mummies, but these bodies. He showed pictures of them. And the interesting thing about, there's two different species, but they're both bipedal. They walk around on two legs, and they have two arms and a head, and the head's a little bit larger than in proportion than our head, both species. Both species are tridactyl. They have three fingers on each hand, three toes on each foot. And that's 12. So right away, I began saying, wait a second. Could these be related to the ancient Sumerian belief? Were the Anunnaki tridactyl? And I've been searching to find a good description of the Anunnaki, if they were indeed tridactyl, and I haven't been too successful yet. Although Jaime recently sent me a picture of a stone that has a five-fingered hand crossed by a three-fingered hand. I think he said that was found in ancient Sumeria someplace. I need to get more information on that. But anyway, that's what got me interested in these bodies, and I started following them. And every now and then I call Jaime, find out what's happening with them, because they were discovered about in 2015 by some grave robbers, which is illegal in Peru. And so had they been caught with the bodies, they probably would go to prison, maybe, and the bodies would have been taken away. So from the period of time where Jaime had gone down with a team of scientists to look at these bodies in April of 2017, over the next 2 years, these bodies were shuffled all around, cardboard boxes, hidden. If you wanted to go down and see them, somehow you had to know somebody that would connect you to the right person. And when you get there, they'd blindfold you and drive you out into the country, and you don't know where you're going. And you get out of the car, and they take you into a building, and they'll take them out of a box. You can see them. So that's what they were doing for 2 years, because no university would take them in. Almost all of the archaeologists within Peru were convinced that these bodies were fake, that they were really a construction of cadaver bones, even though they were over 1,000 years old. And the Ministry of Culture was interested in getting these bodies because it's a problem for them that so much of their culture is being stolen away by grave robbers who sell off artifacts to the highest bidder, you know, in whatever country that person lives in and has the most money to buy these things. It's a big business. And so the Ministry of Culture was interested in getting their hands on these. And I think they might still be interested. But so for a period of about 2 years, in fact, I think there was a document about 300 archaeologists around Peru had signed indicating that these were fake. And they had never even seen them. But they just knew they were fake because that happens a lot there. Anyway, if you see the images in the computer tomography, and I show them in the book, at the end of the book there, it's obvious they're not constructed or put together, that are assembled from bones, because the joints show evidence of connective tissue. And if they had been assembled after the bodies were dead, then the connective tissue would not have grown. And if it was assembled while they were still alive, then there'd be scar tissue. So there's no evidence that they were assembled. The evidence is that they were living beings, and very unusual. The largest species would be who looked very human. She was maybe 5 feet tall, I guess, when she stood up. Very human, except for being tridactyl. And as I said, both species had all their organs intact. And so when they do computer tomography on Maria, that's what they called her, they could do slices. And you could see her lungs and her heart, so forth. And in her gut, in her intestines, there was what looked like feces. And so when I went down to a conference, because by 2019, the University of Ica had stepped forward and said, we will take the bodies. So finally, the bodies were in a safe place, both putting in a safe environment so they wouldn't deteriorate anymore. I think they're cased in an argon atmosphere, and also kept away from the public in a way that people can see them but can't touch them and steal them. So they're protected now. But so Maria then was dated dying 1,750 years ago based on carbon-14 dating of her bones and her skin. But I said, you know, you really should try and get that feces and date it. And the reason for that is carbon-14 dating is only valid if whatever you're analyzing spent its whole life on Earth, because there's a certain ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 that is known for various parts of the planet and also over several thousand years of history. And carbon-14 is radioactive. It's produced in the upper atmosphere by higher energy particles that knock off a neutron off of nitrogen-14 and create a carbon-14. And the carbon-14 is radioactive and has a half-life of about 5,730 years. So if you know today, for instance, there's a certain ratio of carbon-14 to 12 in your body. But when you stop eating, then you don't bring in any more carbon-14 or carbon-12. You're dead. But 5,730 years from now, the number of carbon-14 atoms in your body will be a half of what they were. And so the ratio between the two would have changed. And that's how they use it. It's called radioactive carbon dating. And so that's the way you can date it. But I'm not convinced that Maria or the other species spent their whole life on this planet. So what I was suggesting is that they they date feces. The feces would have been probably the last thing that she ate, and probably was spent its whole life, whatever it was, on this planet. And not only would that show her real age, or when she really died, but if you compare those values with her skin and tissues, you could probably calculate when she arrived on Earth. So her DNA is about 25% human. Now the smaller species, they're really weird because their DNA doesn't match anything. They appear to be reptilian. One of them, actually more than one, actually have eggs in them like a reptile would. Their skin looks reptilian, and they don't appear to have, again, based on computer tomography images, they don't appear to have a heart, lungs, or digestive system. So the question would be, how can they live? And I believe, and this is based also on some readings that I've done on reports of people who have been abducted and actually have seen gray aliens, the gray aliens, that they actually get their nutrients through their skin. They absorb through their skins. And in fact, my fourth novel, Alien Log 4, The Antarctica Affair, the main characters that are in that affair are aliens, and they are these two species. You can see them, just like you can in the last chapter of my book. I show those same images, and they are the aliens that are maintaining the craft that's buried under 1,000 feet of ice in Antarctica. But so these guys don't match any DNA. They don't appear to have a normal digestive system or lungs or anything. And that got me to research because their bone structure, based on the x-rays, resembles a frog structure in the sense that frogs only have one bone, like in their forearms and their legs, whereas we have two. And so, again, looks very much like a frog. So I started researching about frogs, and it turns out, and I didn't know this after all my years that I've been alive, that a frog can actually transpire underwater, can actually breathe underwater through its skin, take in oxygen, and give off CO2. Now, frogs have lungs, so when they're on the surface, they can breathe. Question is, how do they do that? Because they don't have a diaphragm. If you've ever watched a frog sitting there on the edge of a pond, his lower jaw is going up and down. So that's basically their diaphragm. So he would open his nostrils and bring his diaphragm down, take in air into his mouth, close his nostrils, bring his diaphragm up and force it into his lungs. So that's the way a frog breathes. But the important thing is that they can breathe through their skin. And of course, we have medication that we put on our skin for transdermal medication. So we know you can absorb things through your skin. And I think that's the way that species works, is that they absorb through their skin. And that's just my theory. I have no other evidence other than it just seems that way.
We've been talking about your book, which is The Science Behind Alien Encounters, and you've also talked about your science fiction books, and they're all on Amazon, aren't they?
They're all Amazon. The best thing is they go to my website, which is www.alienlog, one word, alienlog.com. They'll find where they can click and get directed right to the proper place in Amazon to get the books.
Fantastic.
They're available e-books, paper books, and in fact, the two Science Behind books, because that's my science series, The Science Behind, those two are now also available as a hardcover if you want a hardcover. I'm working on The Science Behind Creation of Our Universe Without a Big Bang, and also I was toying with the idea of a book about the science behind the amazing mummies of Nazca, Peru. Because I have a lot of information on that. But the next one out will be The Science Behind Creation of Our Universe Without a Big Bang. And it presents the way the book is structured. It's in three parts. The first book is a history of astronomy up till present time, stopping along the way at points in time where either a person or equipment causes a paradigm shift in our understanding of our universe. And then the second part of the book is discusses the Big Bang hypothesis, how it came about, and all the problems with it. And the third part is another alternative approach that's not my own. I didn't create it, but I believe in it, that talks about how the universe came about using the same data that the Big Bang theory has. But it does not violate any science, any laws of physics. It also does not require this mysterious dark energy. And as far as dark matter, you can explain that dark matter does exist, but it's not related to the creation of the universe.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
And that was an interview with Dr. Robert Farrell about his book, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 23 minutes. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, where you can find my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast, and there are nearly 200 episodes, and it is where I look into evidence of the afterlife. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you will get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. And all the links are in the show notes. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And on Twitter, I am at Simon G. Bown. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.